אתם עם SBS בעברית. לעוד סיפורים מעניינים, כנסו ל-sbs.com.au.
Joining us now, we have Liberal Senator and Australian Ambassador to Israel between 2013 to 2017, Dave Sharmat. Dave, welcome to SBS Hebrew.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you for having me on.
It's been a big week coming out of the Middle East. A lot of long-awaited excitement and elation for both Israelis and Palestinians. Dave, what are your thoughts on all this?
I've felt the sense of immense relief and joy at seeing the remaining hostages released, but also, and I very much hope this will hold an end to the conflict in Gaza and the ability for people on all sides and throughout the Middle East to rebuild a better future. So I'm, you know, more optimistic than I've been, I think, in some years, not naively so, but more optimistic than I've been in some years about the prospects for people throughout the region to be able to live their lives in peace without the fear of terrorist groups, you know, focus on their families, on economic development, on integration. Because I think with everything that's happened in the last 2 years, my sense is that the forces of rejection and extremism have been weakened substantially. Not only Hamas, but also terrorist groups like Hezbollah. The Assad regime in Syria has fallen. Iran has been humbled and weakened. And those were really forces that were holding the Middle East back from modernity in many respects. They were irredentist forces. And now I think there is a majority of nations and peoples in the Middle East who want to be involved with progress, want to look towards the future, not litigate the disputes of the past, want to coexist alongside one another, do not see opportunity and advancement as zero sum with their neighbours. So I think there's now a sort of constellation of people who have positive sum thinking in the Middle East. And I think that's what this moment encapsulates for me.
Do you think that it warranted or needed a cataclysmic 2-year bloody war like this in order to propel things forward with different Arab nations and Israel?
I would say that the 2 years of dramatic war and have fundamentally realigned the region. Now, you know, I would never say it's necessary, nor would I ever wish for it. But I think one of the positive consequences, potentially, and there's still a lot of work to do to extract these positive consequences, is that there is now the hope to be able to build a better future. You know, there were many people who were interested and wanted to do that, including Israel, including countries like the United Arab Emirates that signed the Abraham Accords, who have been trying to build that future for a while. But there have been other groups in the region, principally Iran and its sort of terrorist and state entities that it controls, that have been trying to hold that back. But that block, if you like, which has really been the fundamental fault line in the Middle East for these past 2 decades, that block is substantially weakened because of this war. And I think that gives us at least a platform now to build a more hopeful future.
We'll get back to the Abraham Accords in just a minute. But Dave, I want to ask you about your time in Israel as the Australian ambassador. Did you ever feel like peace was within proximity, or did you feel like it was completely out of reach? Because, of course, you were there when the Tzuk Eitan war was happening, another very bloody moment in history between Israel and Hamas. Tell us what your thoughts are.
And what I remember very much from that time, so I was there for the Tzuk Eitan war, which was in the summer of 2014, from memory, the Israeli summer of 2014. And the reason that came about in large part, and I think this has sort of been lost a little to the history, is there had been a peace process and a negotiation effort underway. President Obama's second term, John Kerry was the Secretary of State. John Kerry had basically engineered sort of proximity talks between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, and they had been making progress. They'd been going for close to 9 months. What derailed that fundamentally was Hamas in the West Bank kidnapped and murdered 3 young Israelis. That raised the tensions dramatically, made peace efforts harder, and then it began to launch a barrage of rockets from Gaza, and that's how that war began. But it was very much Hamas's intent there was to, I think, to disrupt that peace effort. And I think we see with this last war, which started with the 7th of October. A large part of Hamas' strategic intent there was to derail what had been growing moves towards Israel-Saudi normalisation. That was the backdrop for the 7th of October 2023, a concern by Hamas and Iran, its backer, that Israel-Saudi normalisation was getting close, and this would, for Iran, sideline them from the region. For Hamas, it would relegate the Palestinian national cause lower down the order, and that was a strategic threat for them. When I was in Israel, 2013 to 2017, you know, I wasn't hopeful that a peace process would conclude during my time as ambassador, but I did have some hope that there were forces of sort of moderation and coexistence who wanted to find a way to accommodate one another's national ambitions and aspirations within the framework of a diplomatic settlement. What we've seen now with the summit in Sharm el-Sheikh is probably the most progress we've seen on that front of a broader regional peace in at least a decade, going back to that effort, but probably more like the sort of Camp David or post-Oslo process of a quarter of a century ago.
What do you make of Benjamin Netanyahu not attending that summit? There are different theories as to why he didn't attend, but what are your thoughts on that?
I'd heard, and I don't know if this is true, that initially he wasn't invited, but then Trump prevailed upon the hosts, Egypt, to issue an invitation, but then Netanyahu didn't take it. I can see pluses and minuses, I guess, to both propositions. Look, obviously, Israel needs to be involved intimately in any future discussion of the regional configuration. But I also accept that in the Arab world, being seen to be too close to Israel and Netanyahu at this particular time, just as the Gaza war has concluded, can make life more difficult for those political leaders and would potentially have the effect of limiting their diplomatic space and flexibility. So, you know, I think in future discussions and summits, Israel and the Arab world need to all be there. But at this very first one, I don't think it was essential.
Now, just going back to the current status quo in Israel and Gaza, Donald Trump has obviously been on his victory lap. He's, and I'm paraphrasing here, concluded 3,000 years of war. He's enjoying all the adulation from different corners of the Middle East. Do we think it's a little bit premature to celebrate, though? I mean, we've barely made it out of phase one. There are still 24 bodies that haven't returned to Israel, the deceased bodies that was part of this phase, which the Israeli government's calling a gross violation of the deal. What are we to make of this? Where does that leave us now? If they're not going to return the bodies, then where does this leave us?
Yeah, President Trump's sort of diplomatic style is, yeah, he trades in hyperbole, right? Domestically and internationally. He has a tendency to kind of overstate the significance of some things, but in part that's a sort of personal trait, but in part it's also a tactic to try and, I think, create a sense of inevitability and optimism. And I think that's sorely needed in the Middle East, right? It's generally speaking, doesn't have a lot of cause for optimism, and he's trying to inject it. And of course, you know, by him sort of having this summed and everything else before all these details are finalized and agreed, it's sort of inverted the usual process where you agree all the details and every phase and every chapter and every protocol before you put your name on a piece of paper or handshake an agreement. Donald Trump's doing that in reverse in some respects. He's declaring an agreement and then saying the details are there to be finalized. But I think by doing that, he has made sure that all countries have bought into this. They bought in with their national prestige, with their publics, and now the onus is upon them to make it work. Hamas obviously does need to return the bodies, and it's important that the same parties that basically brought Hamas to the table, Qatar, Egypt and Turkey, need to make sure it delivers on that side of the bargain. And Israel is perfectly entitled and within its rights to raise this as an issue. And the United States should continue, as Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner, the others, should continue to make sure that the agreement is implemented and honoured in the detail. Yes, you could say that sort of the celebrations are premature, but in some senses they're designed to kind of create some positive and unstoppable momentum that will mean that obstacles will be overcome by the sort of sense of inevitability around it.
Certainly capitalizing off this momentum now would be the best mechanism, I suppose. So the deal mentions a potential phase two involving Hamas disarming or withdrawing. From your perspective, how realistic is that? Have you seen what's been going on now in the Gaza Strip? There are different factions fighting against each other, Hamas included.
It's not easy, but I have some hope that there are strong enough internal non-Hamas actors in Gaza that can challenge its rule, if you like, its dominance, its monopoly on the use of force. If the countries that have provided Hamas its diplomatic and financial lifeline for the past two decades, Qatar, Turkey and Egypt, keep the pressure on, then Hamas probably can't be eliminated, but it can be marginalised. And I sort of, look, I draw the parallel here a little bit with Lebanon, right? Hezbollah was basically the de facto government of Lebanon. It exercised a stranglehold not only in Lebanon's official institutions, its parliament, its government, its ministries, but also it ran an army outside an army, right? The Lebanese armed forces would not go into Hezbollah's strangleholds and tackle it. After Israel's operation against Hezbollah and its senior leadership, what has happened is the other centres of power within Lebanon, the other institutions have been able to reassert themselves. And Hezbollah is not abolished or gone. It still exists, but it's been pushed right into the lower levels. And I think that's possible with Hamas. Hamas has obviously been weakened through this. Its outside patrons no longer see it as being an asset. And there are clearly other actors within Gaza who, for very good reasons, are deeply unhappy with how Hamas has run the place and what they've caused in these past 2 years. It's hard for us, especially in Australia, but it's also hard for Israel to empower those actors directly. But what we can do is try and keep the pressure on Hamas and allow them to rise up organically. Now, there's not a high degree of certainty with any of that, but I can certainly see a scenario where Hamas becomes a diminished and marginalized political and military force, and over time, other institutions in Gaza that have more legitimacy, that aren't committed to the destruction of Israel in the same way, that are more interested in the welfare of their own people, can begin to assert control and amass influence themselves.
So looking beyond Gaza, what impact might this deal have on the Abraham Accords?
Importantly, the Abraham Accords survived this war, and that wasn't necessarily certain at the start. And I think that's an important achievement. So, you know, the Abraham Accords survived this war. Israel's peace treaties and diplomatic relations with Egypt and Jordan survived this war. And those are all important sort of stabilizing assets within the region. I do see a potential to, you know, expand the Abraham Accords and ensure that Israel is recognized and accepted by all countries in the region.
So you think it's still on the front?
Look, the new government in Syria is clearly keen to normalize its relationship with Israel. I think the new government in Lebanon, minus Hezbollah, is interested. You know, those are the two other states that border Israel that do not have diplomatic relations with it, that do not recognize it. And over time, I think the remaining Gulf states, that's possible. That should be the goal, the end state, but it would be a little reckless to sort of rush towards it now, saying, right, the Gaza war's concluded. You know, who's signing up next to the Abraham Accords? This will need time to settle. I think confidence and trust needs to be rebuilt. Israel's relations with its neighbours, including Egypt and Jordan and the UAE and others, have clearly frayed through this conflict, and that was always going to happen. And I think some time needs to be built for that level of trust to be reestablished. And then I think, yes, we could look at expanding them. That's very much the Trump administration's goal, right? I think, you know, his crowning achievement will be Saudi-Israel normalization. That is really peace in the Middle East, right? That's what peace in the Middle East looks like. No countries who are committed ideologically or politically to the destruction of any other country. You know, that's the basis for peace.
Can you see a world in which Israel will be having diplomatic and trade relations with their Palestinian neighbours?
I very much can. One of the more hopeful things I did when I was the ambassador is I went to a planned town called Rawabi, which is about 10 kilometres north of Ramallah in the West Bank. And it was basically a newly built town. A Palestinian businessman was involved. But that town, you know, from the artisans to the stonework to the builders to the construction supplies, everything else, is basically building a middle-class neighbourhood for the Palestinian professional classes. That whole project involved a remarkable level of economic integration with Israel, you know, from trades to stonework to raw materials to building materials. And the businessman who was the sort of brainchild behind it recognized that Palestinians' economic future was intimately tied up with Israel's economic future, that, you know, they needed access to Israel's ports, but also Israel's capital and expertise and trades and skills to be able to flourish economically. And Israel, in the reverse, provided a market and an outlet for Palestinian goods and services. And I can see a future. I mean, inevitably, the success of the Palestinian territories, and if it comes about a Palestinian state, will be intimately tied up with their level of economic integration with Israel. They're not going to be able to be.
And independently. They can't do it happily independently.
No, no. And they can't rely only on an outlet to Jordan or to Egypt if you're in Gaza for trade. I mean, those economies are way too non-complementary. They're way too competitive. But with Israel, I think there's a possibility. And you would have heard all these stories before the first intifada. I mean, you know, Israelis would go to Gaza to buy the markets and seafood, and Gazan workers would come and work on Israeli construction projects. And even before the 7th of October, there was, you know, 10 to 20,000 Gazans coming and working each day in Israel. And I think that is the economic future of the Palestinian people in the region, and a higher level of economic integration would be good for Israel and good for the Palestinian people. But obviously that will require a significant rebuilding of trust.
Dave, I also want to quickly ask you, because we're running out of time, I want to ask you about the pro-Palestinian marches. They're still happening around the world. The latest one's in yesterday, I believe, in northern Italy in a town called Udine, just before the Israeli-Italian World Cup, I believe. 5,000 people coming out protesting against Israel. What's happening here? Why are these demonstrations continuing? What are they protesting for?
Well, I think what the continuation of these protests, and it's obviously happening in Sydney, my hometown, and elsewhere in Australia, shows you is that these protests were never about the conflict or the war. And though they dressed themselves up as being pro-ceasefire, they wanted a ceasefire now, they wanted an end to the fighting. They've got that right, but they're continuing to protest. And I think at heart, the protesters' grievance is with the existence of the state of Israel. And that's why they keep falling into slogans like, from the river to the sea, or describing Israel as a, I don't like using the words, but, you know, derogatory words, colonialist, apartheid, whatever it might be, because they fundamentally have an objection to the existence of a sovereign homeland for the Jewish people in the land of Israel. And I think that's why they're continuing to protest. So the ceasefire to them is immaterial. The conflict was a useful exercise for them to go and protest about. But now that that's done, it's, you know, their grievance has not been addressed. Their grievance was never about the war between Israel and Hamas. Their grievance is Israel is still there. In my view, demanding that the only Jewish majority and Jewish homeland state in the world, but it has no right to be there, is discrimination on the basis of ethnicity or religion. It's anti-Semitism. Yes, it is. And I think anyone who's calling for the destruction of the state of Israel, they will try and say they're anti-Zionist, but they're not anti-Semitic. I don't think you can distinguish between those two features if you're calling for the destruction of Israel. Of course, Israel and Israel's government can and should be held to account and critiqued and criticised and whatnot, but I can't think of any other nation around the world where people take to the streets and say Azerbaijan has no cause to be there, or why is Georgia still there, or South Sudan should never have been granted independence, or whatever it might be, right? This is quite different. No one's saying Israel's government should change. These protesters aren't saying, yeah, no, they don't like Netanyahu, but they're not saying we want a centre-left government in Israel. They're saying we don't want any government in Israel. We don't want Israel to be there. And I think that's anti-Semitism.
So what are Jews expected to do, Jews and the diaspora expected to do?
Look, it's hard, and I know it's been an incredibly trying and difficult time for Jews in Australia and throughout the diaspora around the world, because they felt, you know, under siege. They felt attacked. They felt threatened. They've had their identity challenged. They've had their rights as citizens diminished or encroached upon. But I would say that you have to keep standing up and keep fighting and stand up for your rights as citizens of the country that you're in Australia. You know, you have rights to political assembly and political expression and to conduct a business and to go to places of worship and to send your kids to Jewish schools and everything else, but also stand up for Israel. I mean, I don't think you should shy away from that argument that Israel is, to my mind, a moral liberal democracy that is living in a difficult part of the world that has to take decisions on an everyday basis that our political system in Australia would find incredibly difficult to confront and challenge, where the margin of survival is slim, where you have people around you who have, you know, spent their lives plotting the destruction of Israel or the killing of Israelis and death to Jewish people. In such a situation like that, I mean, it's an incredibly difficult place to run a state. You know, you should, I think, defend Israel's moral character and point out its pluralism and its freedom and its democracy and the fact that there are lively internal debates about all of these issues in Israel as well, from any number of things, right? The conduct of the war to the strategy to release the hostages to, you know, the engagement with the peace process and all. These are all parts of political debate in Israel. I think Jewish people need to be prepared to, if they're Zionists, and I think overwhelmingly Jewish people in Australia are Zionists and elsewhere around the world, then they should be prepared to stand up for that. Because I think, you know, what I found troubling in Australia is too few people in my position in elected office have been prepared to make the moral arguments and the ethical arguments at this time. People have sort of wanted to hide from the mob or hide from the crowd or avoid the social media pile-on. And that, I can understand that, right? But especially people who have public office, I think, have a duty to speak out on these things in a way that ordinary citizens don't have the same duty. They have their rights, but they don't have the same duty. I think people in public office need to be prepared to speak hard truths in unpopular settings, you know, if you like. Jewish Australians should be prepared to do as well, to a degree, to the degree they're comfortable with it.
Now, how much of your confidence in putting your head above the parapet for the Jewish community here in Australia do you attribute to having lived in Israel and having had that firsthand intimate experience of being in that country?
Well, I think it gives me a lot of confidence because I know the country very well and there's not a lot of Australians who do. So, you know, I'm confident that I can marshal the facts and the knowledge and the experience to support my arguments. Half of Australians think I'm Jewish. I'm not, so I'll just put that out there to your audience. But because I'm not Jewish, people would doubt this, but I think I came to this issue independently, you know, and I've always viewed myself as an observer of these issues. And I spent time in Israel, you know, I traveled to Gaza, I traveled to the West Bank. I knew Israeli Arabs, but I also knew many Palestinians as well. And I spent time listening to their perspectives, and I have empathy with the Palestinian national perspective as a people. But I don't think I approach this issue with a view to the welfare of Israel and the Jewish people, but also the Palestinian people. But I think that gives me, to my mind, a right and an ability to speak out on these issues. And it helps ground my opinions or my analysis, I think, in expertise. And I think that's, generally speaking, very lacking in Australia, where people who don't know much about this conflict tend to position it in very binary terms. Like most difficult things in life, it's much more complicated than that.
Before we finish up, do you have any fond memories of living in Israel, or do you have any connections there still?
Look, I have hundreds of fond memories. My three children, who were 6 and 4 and a newborn when we moved there, now significantly older, but they've got very fond memories too. And for me, it's sort of the place where we raised our family, my wife and I. I mean, I've got so many fond memories, from camping trips to visiting historical and archaeological sites to our great meals to time on the beach to running in the Galilee to mountain biking trips in the Negev to seeing some amazing science and technology and entrepreneurs and startups. So the like Friday afternoons when you can feel Israel kind of just breathe out and become quiet for Shabbat afternoons. All of those things are incredibly fond memories for me. And I learned so much, I think, and grew so much, as did my wife as a person, just being exposed to the culture, the history, the civilization, the environment. You know, it's contributed meaningfully to who I am today. And yeah, I maintain a lot of friendships in Israel. I mean, I'm still always in touch with people in Israel all the time. I was there last year. I'll probably visit again next year, that whenever people from Israel are out in Australia, I'll always connect with them and keep in touch with them. Still very in touch with Israeli journalists, Israeli politicians, our old vet from our rescue cats that we adopted in Israel, Alon. I'm still in touch with him. So yeah, I maintain a lot of friendships and connections there.
It's good to know. That's a great connection to have.
He knows our cats better than we do, so we still advise from time to time.
Wow, that's important. Dave, thank you so much for joining us here on SBS Hebrew.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me. עקבו אחרינו והפיצו אותנו דרך דף הפייסבוק שלנו.